This is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry, and I want you to go back in time with me to May of 1963. Yeah, Jimmy Soul was singing about happiness as he rose up the Billboard charts, but it belied the mood of a nation in pain.
These are the front lines of the battle between Dr. Martin Luther King's Negro Disciples of Nonviolence and the uniformed forces of Birmingham, led by Commissioner Eugene Bull Connor, who says, "We were trying to be nice to them, but they won't let us be."
The movement to end racial segregation in Georgia had stalled after an unsuccessful effort in Albany. Dr. King was jailed in Birmingham, and the SCLC was having trouble recruiting volunteers for its nonviolent direct action efforts. That was when strategist James Bevel introduced a stunning and difficult idea. Put school-aged children on the front lines of the protests to end Jim Crow. Over 1,000 young people responded to the call for action. They gathered at the 16th Street Baptist Church, and they began marching peacefully in small groups, singing freedom songs. But the Birmingham police, under the direction of the infamous Bull Connor, had no intention of allowing these children to assemble or march. Officers attacked the young people with dogs, batons, and high-powered fire hoses. That night, Americans across the nation were forced to reckon with this racist state violence enacted against children.
Lo and behold, coming off of the steps at the 16th Street Baptist Church, there were 25 to 40, 50 sheriffs across the road with these little batons in their hands at the ready.
First, we were faced with the dogs and the water hose.
And speaking through a megaphone, said, "Get out of this line or you're going to jail." I was so intimidated by facing a white man. I'd never had that encounter.
We were put in a cell block, I understand, holds 650 people. And this cell block had over 1,500 people in it. It was a ferocious thunderstorm that day. And I can recall several of the girls said that God don't even want us.
That sound is from the History Channel special on the Children's Crusade of 1963. And those are the voices of actual participants. They're now adults, but you can still hear the fear, the distress they must have felt facing those officers. Now, when we think about police violence against Black children today, we tend to think of fatal encounters, like 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant, who was fatally shot by Columbus, Ohio police officer Nicholas Reardon, or 12-year-old Tamir Rice, gunned down by officers on a Cleveland playground in 2014. And of course, 18-year-old Michael Brown, killed by police in Ferguson, Missouri. But it would be a mistake to imagine that the only harms Black youth endure at the hands of police are fatal. A recent report by the Marshall Project shows that Black children who survive troubling encounters with police are disproportionately likely to be hurt, harmed, and traumatized by the officer's use of force. According to researchers at UC Berkeley, Black girls in California are 4 times more likely to experience excessive force by police than white girls, no matter how young they are. And research shows that officers perceive Black girls to be more adult and less innocent than white girls, no matter how young they are. Now, here's an example you might remember. And listen, we're going to play some sound of children in pain, and we're just warning you so it's not a shock. Although, maybe it needs to be. In June of 2015, an officer was called to a disturbance at a pool party in McKinney, Texas. He pulled a gun on the Black teenagers at the pool and pushed a girl, still in her bikini bathing suit, onto the sidewalk. He forced her head to the ground, sat on her back. It sounds like chaos, right? And that's the context of a lot of these moments. It's tough to hear, but the girl is begging the officer not to touch her. That same year, a school resource officer in Columbia, South Carolina, forcibly ripped a 14-year-old girl from her seat, flipped her desk, and dragged her across the room because she would not give him her cell phone.
I will get your dad.
No, you said that you were going to pepper spray me. No, please, no, stop.
And in February of this year, a police officer in Rochester, New York, handcuffed and pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl who was screaming for her father.
I got her.
In 2016, a 15-year-old black girl named Breonna Stewart was riding her bicycle in the predominantly white neighborhood of Hagerstown, Maryland.
Well, I thought it was just a normal day. I was just going to go ride my bike.
I spoke with Breonna and asked her about that day.
I was just, you know, spending time outside riding my bicycle. I was actually going to go meet up with a friend, and he said he was going to be a little late, so I continued to ride around by the area where we were supposed to meet at. It's called Fairgrounds. We were going to play basketball. And in that time that I was waiting on him, I got hit by a vehicle. And everything just kind of changed from that point on in my life.
After determining that she was okay, the driver who hit Breonna called 911. And Breonna wanted to go home. But when the police arrived on the scene, they had no intention of letting her leave. Officers tried to question Breonna, but she was scared. She yelled, she cursed, she tried to get on her bike and ride home, but the police proceeded to pull her off her bike, force her into a police car, and pepper spray her in the face before driving her down to the station and cuffing her to a bench. And remember, this is a 15-year-old child who'd just been hit by a car. Listen.
Okay, so you're going to step back. I'll just spray her.
Put your feet in, you're getting sprayed.
There's a lot of noise here, but you can hear just how frightened and upset she is. You never know from that sound that Breonna was the victim that police had been called to assist.
I feel as though it should have never happened. And yes, I do feel as if they were treating me as if I did something wrong, like as if I was a criminal.
A few days after the incident, Breonna and the police department each spoke publicly about their encounter. And initially, she was not charged with any wrongdoing. But then they changed their tune.
The video that was taken on my cell phone was posted. And from that point forward, they never charged, like they released me the same day and they told my mom that, you know, I wasn't charged with anything, that they just wanted to question me. After the video was posted, my lawyer and us, we had like a little conference meeting. I think that's what it's called, or told my story. I said what happened. And then right after that, the police had their press conference, and the police officers said that they were charging me with all these charges.
Ultimately, Breonna wrote an apology to officers for cursing and kicking. All the charges were dropped. But here's what we want to draw attention to. Breonna suffered more harm at the hands of police officers called to help than from the driver who hit her with a car. Even more troubling is knowing that her experience is not an isolated one. Breonna says what happened to her was inevitable.
From what my parents told me, and what I've seen, you know, I knew not to talk to the police, for one, because I'm a minor, and two, you know, that it's bound to happen. it's just bound to happen because I'm of color.
For more on the use of force against black girls, I spoke with Abby Van Sickle, staff writer for the Marshall Project, a news organization that covers the criminal justice system. Abby reported on Breonna and other black girls facing harm at the hands of authorities.
The trauma of these incidents lasts many years, you know, after the incident. One mother talked about how her daughter now sleeps with a weighted blanket to try to soothe her to sleep. another mother whose daughter had had a police officer sit on her back, said that her daughter wakes up yelling out for, you know, people to get off of her back. You know, parents reported that their kids, you know, became less outgoing, stayed in the house more often. Even those who said that they had trusted police before said that they would no longer trust the police if they were in trouble. And I thought all of those things were really important because they were such a pattern in the interviews that we did.
It's always a bad idea to take journalistic stories personally as a host, as a journalist, but this one really did hit me. My eldest niece was 16 years old when she was arrested on the south side of Chicago for standing in the wrong line at McDonald's. She went to an all-black, large public high school, and the black franchise owner at the McDonald's had created, during the lunchtime hour when the high school kids would come in, like basically a separate but equal line where the high school kids were forced to sit, you know, stand in one line and sit in one part of the restaurant. And she stood in the wrong line, the adult line, and was arrested, handcuffed by Chicago police, and transported back to her school in a police wagon vehicle. And she is 32 now, and that trauma is still absolutely on the surface. Like, it, I can't think of a Thanksgiving or a Christmas holiday where she hasn't talked about it with us 16 years later.
A couple of things. One is that we found the experience, you're talking about, you know, something where you are in, quote, the wrong line at a McDonald's, that many of the incidents where families and youths, some now adults, share their stories started with things as minor as that. Some girls in Florida going to a condominium pool and some neighbors thinking that they shouldn't have been able to use the pool. In Brianna's case, a bike accident. Some kids at a trampoline park outside of St. Louis. That, you know, many of the incidents started small and then quickly escalated into something that ended up sticking with those kids, you know, into, you know, in some cases into adulthood. I also had reached out to some experts who train police officers in working with youth and in interacting with them. And one of the things that came up in those interviews is the focus on brain development, that, you know, teenagers, your niece's brain was still developing when that happened, and that those experiences during our middle school and high school years can be so formative and can really stick with us for years. And I think that's something that really did come out in the reporting.
Why does this happen? let's start with why police typically use use of force with anyone, and then particularly why it is happening with minors and then with Black girls.
We were able to get data. We were able to, you know, do a lot of interviews. The why of why it happens to Black girls is something that, you know, we really tried to get at in the journalism. And what I can tell you, you know, from our reporting is that from use of force experts, they talk about how police are many times taught to maintain control of an encounter. So they are taught often that maintaining control is paramount, and also that anyone can be a threat, whether it is, you know, a child or an older person. And so if there's a moment in an encounter where somebody talks back, doesn't immediately do what police are telling them to do, that can be seen as a threat to the control of the situation. And so police, that's oftentimes, even from the videos of these incidents, you can see that that's that moment when somebody talks back, pushes back against the police, that seems like it's when these incidents really escalate into a use of force. And, you know, there's no specific rules, no national rules around when and how police use force against kids and youths. It is one of the factors that they take into account when they're using force, but it's just one of, you know, of many factors.
I know that we have research out of multiple advocacy and academic institutions suggesting that Black children are typically seen as older, more adult than they actually are, and that Black girls in particular are seen as adults when they're still very much children. Is that part of what's happening here?
You know, that's something that came up in the reporting process, that, you know, in Brianna's case, if you have seen any of the video of what happened or met Brianna, she's quite petite. And so the idea that she could be perceived as older than she is, I found to be, you know, a little bit hard to imagine. But that is something that because of her race and because of the way that adults, you know, see Black girls as older, that's something that came up. Kristen Henning, who's a professor at Georgetown Law, you know, has really studied this, as have some other academics at the Georgetown Law Center on Poverty and Inequality. And I call it the adultification of Black youth, that they are perceived as less innocent and older than they are. And so I thought that was really important to get that research into our piece.
Talk to me about potential solutions. Is this something we just have to live with? Or are there ways that either training or awareness or, you know, holding people accountable, officers in particular, can make a difference?
Yeah. So on the training front, I spent a lot of time talking with people who train police officers specifically on interacting with youth. And that I thought was really important work to also get into the piece. Lisa Thoreau is one of the leading experts on this. She has an organization that has trained officers in more than 20 states. And in their trainings, they focus on not only sort of understanding the teenage brain, brain development, the typical behaviors that teenagers exhibit. Like we all know, because we were all teenagers, or we have teenagers, impulsivity, talking back, distrust of authority, that these are all totally normal. And so how do officers figure out how they're going to respond so that they slow down encounters, that they talk to kids in language that's appropriate for the kid's age, and also, you know, to ask questions like, how can I help you? How can we work through this? Ways that engage in a positive way, or, you know, to try to de-escalate something rather than, for example, seeing a kid who's clearly in some kind of crisis and saying something like, calm down, which every expert that I talked to said that actually is like the worst thing you can say, because it just inflames and blows up something rather than what is the goal, which is to slow things down and actually have someone calm down to a point where they can really interact, you know, in a clear way.
So I guess I'm sitting here thinking about this training question. And I guess, I mean, when you are an officer who has arrived on the scene after the EMTs and you are dealing with anyone who has just been in an accident, I guess I'm a little surprised that official training would even be necessary. Like, isn't there, I don't know, common sense about you don't then at any point pepper spray that person, particularly if they're a child?
You know, I talked with Shelley Kutkowski, she's a police officer and a trainer in North Carolina. And we talked for a long time about her experience training younger officers. And she said one of the things that comes up for her a lot are officers who are young, may not have families, don't have a ton of life experience yet. And also, she said she started to see people coming through who don't have a lot of experience or skill set in, you know, interacting person to person with somebody, as opposed to, you know, texting with someone over a device and so she actually spends a lot of time, she said, focusing on just practical common sense ways of interacting with people before going out onto the streets as an officer.
Abby Van Sickle, staff writer for the Marshall Project. It's a news organization covering the criminal justice system. And we also heard from Brianna Stewart, brave survivor of exactly this kind of police conduct. Thank you both.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much for having us.
Oklahoma, Georgia, Wisconsin, these places represent three cases that highlight the American criminal justice system and the problem of racial injustice. We've been following the case of Julius Jones, who was sentenced to death by the state of Oklahoma after being convicted of murder in 1999. Back in September, the Oklahoma Pardon and Parole Board recommended commutation of Jones's sentence. The governor did not act on this recommendation, asking instead for a clemency decision. On November 1st, the board recommended clemency, and it's now up to Governor Kevin Stitt's office whether to approve the recommendation before Jones is scheduled to be executed on November 18th, just 8 days from now. On Monday, students from the University of Oklahoma, where Jones was a student at the time of his arrest, protested in support of Jones and in order to pressure Governor Stitt to approve the clemency.
I'm not free
till Julius is free.
Justice for
Julius.
In Brunswick, Georgia, a trial is in progress for three white men, Gregory McMichael, Travis McMichael, and William Bryan, who are charged with the murder of Ahmaud Arbery, a black man who was jogging through a neighborhood in Brunswick, Georgia last February. A jury of 11 white jurors and only one black juror was selected and sworn in on Friday. And in Kenosha, Wisconsin, another trial is underway for Kyle Rittenhouse, who's charged with shooting and killing two people and shooting and wounding another at a Black Lives Matter protest last summer. Rittenhouse is white, as are the three men he shot. The protests in Kenosha began after a white police officer shot Jacob Blake, a black man, 7 times in the back during a domestic disturbance complaint. To walk us through these ongoing trials, we're joined by Nicole Lewis, Senior Editor of Jurisprudence at Slate. Nicole, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me on.
Let's start in Georgia with the trial of the three men accused of the murder of Arbery. Last time we talked, the jury selection was just beginning. Now a nearly all-white jury has been selected. What does this tell you about what may happen in this case?
Right. So there was a big question at the start of the case as jury selection was getting underway if this would be a fair trial. And one of the indicators for many people in that town is what the jury selection looks like, what the jury's, you know, who's actually on the jury. And so it's interesting to point out that the judge pointed that there might be an appearance of some intentional discrimination now that there's only one black man on the jury, but he refused to hear the prosecutor's challenge to reseat 8 black jurors, right? So he just allowed this jury to stand. It's important to note that people cannot be struck or should not be struck from juries just on the race alone, but prosecutors and defense attorneys have become so savvy and sophisticated at asking proxy questions that would allow them to show that they have some sort of other grounds for striking a juror, but that those grounds, you know, are clearly highly tied and highly connected to race.
So just so for folks who may not be sitting at home and following every minute of the jury selection, was this so racially skewed jury because the jury pool itself was so racially skewed? In other words, were there very few African Americans who were in the pool, or was it about prosecutors being able to make a decision to strike who they wanted in the jury?
Well, I mean, a little bit of both. So the county itself is predominantly white. I think it's about, you know, 75% white and 25% black, right? But there were black jurors. There were hundreds of people selected so that you can have a nice crosscut of the community. But there were tons of questions asked during the jury selection process that are just sort of coded terms that would allow the defense or allow the prosecution to strike people as they see fit, right? So one of the questions being asked was about the Confederate flag and what it represents. And so you can imagine for Black people living in a Southern town, the Confederate flag has a particular meaning. But in the courtroom, it may look like if you say, yes, the Confederate flag is a symbol of the racist South, that you're somehow not neutral or not objective and therefore not eligible to decide this case, right? And so you get struck for cause.
All right. One more question on the trial in Georgia. We talked a bit about video footage of the shooting before. Was the video footage discussed at all in this jury selection process?
I think one of the ways that it came up, and this is a real tricky part for a case like this that had such incredible local and national media attention was, were they going to be able to find anybody in this jury who had not seen the video, who had not heard of the case, you know, prior to being selected? Could they find someone who was just completely neutral and uninformed about what happened? And that was not the case. Pretty much everyone who came on that jury stand through jury selection had seen something, had heard something about it. And the question for the defense and for the prosecution is, had that already meant that they had made up their minds here? Or could they be, you know, impartial, neutral observers to make a decision?
All right. I want to move to the Kyle Rittenhouse trial. I want to start with a little bit of sound from the judge in that trial, who made headlines in the last couple of weeks over his issue of prosecutors referring to the men who were shot as victims. Let's listen.
This is a long held opinion of mine, which very few judges, I guess, share with me. I think it's a loaded, the word victim is a loaded, loaded word.
All right. What is going on there?
Yeah. So he does have a longstanding policy in which he does not allow anyone to refer to the deceased or to the aggrieved as victims. And that has been a policy in his courtroom for many years. And the idea here, right, is that the defense's case for Rittenhouse is that he's acting in self-defense. And so by calling the people who he murdered and the one person who he shot, their victims, that already suggests that he's guilty. But I think, again, here we have to point out that this same judge who's saying that victim is a loaded word made it okay for the defense to call Rittenhouse's victims looters and rioters, you know, if they felt that the label fit. And so you can ask yourself, if like, if victim is a loaded word, then isn't looter and rioter also a loaded word? That it suggests somehow that these people were criminals who deserved to be shot, who deserved to be wounded, who were in the process of committing crimes. You know, so it just, again, really calls into that question about fairness and balance here.
Now, Rittenhouse is white. The three people he shot are also white. There isn't any question that he shot them, right? But the way that this becomes a racial justice issue is because they were shot at a Black Lives Matter protest. Help us understand this.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a number of things, actually. So they were shot at a Black Lives Matter protest. They were shot at a protest that, you know, erupted after police shot and killed a Black man in Wisconsin. Just the very fact that Rittenhouse took an AR-15, got in his car, right, drove to Kenosha under the auspices of defending this car dealership, right? All of that has racial implications. It makes us think about militias. It makes us think about just how people have responded to any kind of unrest in cities. And the sort of legacy there, right? And so what draws a 17-year-old to say, we need to go work on the side of the police and I need this assault rifle in order to defend property? I mean, I think that all of those things have huge racial implications. And so because his victims are white, you know, they were there in support of anti-racism, of saying, you know, no more police killings. And somehow, you know, Rittenhouse is saying, you know, we got to protect these cars. Like, this becomes crucially important. And I'm working on the side of the police and I somehow am imbued with some sort of right that allows me to do this as a private citizen.
A private citizen, but also a teenager. I'm wondering the extent to which the conversation about his age is going to emerge. We know an awful lot about brain development and about, particularly with, you know, under 25-year-old boys. And look, this is not about an excuse, but it is that I think in many cases, for example, on the show, we have some concerns about teenagers being tried in an adult court.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you know, Rittenhouse is 18 now, but he was 17 when he committed these crimes. And over the course of the past decade, the criminal justice system has been reconsidering the way they think about crimes committed by young people. And these are people, you know, up to age 25, now understanding that our brains don't fully develop and our executive functioning still, you know, is being sorted out. And so I think there will be big questions about, you know, how impulsive was he? Was he able to make reasonable, rational decisions here? You know, was he caught up in the heat of the moment? But one thing that the prosecution has made clear in their case was there were many other people out there that night, many of them also teenagers and young people. And Rittenhouse was the only person who shot and killed two people and wounded one other. And so, you know, they're trying to suss out, is there something that sets him apart here? How can it be that he's the only one who committed violence that night?
Got it. Nicole Lewis is the senior editor of jurisprudence at Slate. Nicole, thanks for joining us and keeping us up to date.
Thanks for having me.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry.
I believe that Motown and Shakespeare, Motown and great history, the vernacular traditions of African-American culture and Richard Dana's 2 years before the mass were integral to creating and crafting a vision of the world that would sustain me as a particular person of color in late 20th century American society.
That was Professor Michael Eric Dyson speaking on PBS in 1996. Now, throughout his career, Dyson has established himself as a public intellectual who thrives on complicating the lines between what's considered the academy and what's considered public life. This month, he's out with a new book entitled Entertaining Race, Performing Blackness in America. It collects essays and speeches he's published and given over the course of his career, examining the intersections between Black identity and performance. And he remains committed to the idea that it's worth bringing a heightened level of intellectual rigor to a wide range of subjects.
Some have believed you only focus on, you know, highfalutin, sophisticated, cerebrally acute expansions of thought that happen in a chapter, say, for instance, like my chapter on Jacques Derrida and his relationship to Black religion, but not, say, in a profile I did of, you know, Catherine Bigelow for Elle magazine.
His recently published collection of essays made me want to take a look back with Dyson across his career. But we begin by speaking about the one entirely new piece of writing in the book. It's an in-depth analysis of Black performance in the U.S. And the essay begins in a disturbing place by recounting Captain John Kimber's 1791 murder of an enslaved Nigerian girl who refused to dance for the ship's crew on a slaving ship.
I wanted to begin there because I wanted to set the predicate for performance of Blackness in the New World. And that story perfectly encapsulates, with its horror, its tragedy, the refusal of a Black girl to perform as the basis of performance for Blackness in our own New World, in America, where from the very beginning, performance has been forced upon us, thrust upon us. Not that we didn't have performance before then, we did. Before being absconded from African shores and extracted from our native haunts and dispersed throughout the New World, we had so much rich performance. But on that slave ship, that young girl was forced to perform. They used to, as you know, dance the captives to keep the enslaved people, you know, their limbs limber, and to keep them fresh, and also to titillate the mates of the ship and sexually at some points, and to entertain them on the long journey. The enslaved people were forced to get up probably daily to dance. And on this particular occasion, this young lady had been infected with a venereal disease, ironically enough, by the doctor of the ship, and she didn't feel well and refused to get up to dance and perform. She was hung upside down by one leg with barely a loincloth around her middle part, naked for the most part, and beat to death. And at trial, Captain Kimber at trial for her death and the death of another young lady, it was discovered that because of her refusal to dance, because of her refusal to perform, she was murdered. That is the basis of performance in Black America, in this world, that we are constantly forced, constantly pushed to perform for whiteness, to perform an identity that has been thrust upon us, but also resistively to perform our own identity. So that story captured so much of what and who we are.
In some ways, the book is a bit of a Michael Dyson reader. You begin there, but you also move back and forth across time, sort of mostly the last decade, but a little bit from some of it that's older. You even dip on back into the 90s, congressional testimonies, kind of stuff. I'm wondering about where you are in your own life, your own profession right now, that it felt like what you wanted to do in part was to organize your own thinking and speaking and writing in this way.
Yeah, it's fascinating because, look, when I started out 30 some odd years ago, you know, I'd get a PhD. And 2 years after that PhD, I was on the cover of The New Yorker magazine in a story that spoke about by Michael Berube, the noted literary critic, a story about this new generation of Black public intellectuals. And I was the youngest by far of those featured: Cornel West, Bell Hooks, Derrick Bell, and myself. And so that was my entree around 95 into those precincts of privilege of public intellectual discourse with all its controversies and possibilities, its conflicts and tensions. And now, recently, I've been favored and blessed to have appeared on the New York Times bestseller lists, along with, say, a new generation of Ta-Nehisi Coates and others who now reside there. So my journey has been that of a long distance runner, so to speak. And when I, you know, look around the landscape now and see a Melissa Harris Perry as one of the prominent public intellectuals in America, you know, I've kind of measured my distance from pole to pole. And so I wanted to look around and see, given this new, fresh, powerful generation of thinking and thinkers and reflection on who we are as a people, where we are, where the struggles are, to look at some of the consistent themes that I've articulated that perhaps didn't have as much resonance then as they do now, writing about Black women when it wasn't a thing of Black girl magic or Black boy joy, speaking about homosexuality or gay identity or LGBTQIA in a sermon or, you know, in a debate when it had not yet come to a particular point of conflict and tension that was so visible. So, you know, I wanted to look back and see the stuff I've done and where I've been and where I am now as I reflect on, you know, where we are as a nation in a racial reckoning and a pandemic and trying to come to grips with yet another iteration, yet another controversy, yet another moment of Blackness, which is why, you know, when I talk about critical race theory in the book or when I'm speaking about particular issues of social dislocation vis-a-vis, say, hip-hop culture, I've been grappling with those for a while. So it was a way for me to understand myself and to organize my thoughts around themes that have been particularly and especially visible in the culture now that I've been at for a moment.
How is it that you got Cosby right before so many others managed to do so?
You know, from the beginning, when I commented in the pages of the New York Times, when they called me after reading me the comments Mr. Cosby made that night in, what was it, 2004 or five, around there. And I said he was a typical elitist responding to the persistent problems of young Black people and those who are poor. And Mr. Cosby called me up and, you know, as he is wont to do, and said to me, "You're a famous Black intellectual and I'm a famous entertainer. We don't have to do this in the press." I was like, "Yes, sir, let's talk." And he told me that basically I had been fed a bunch of lies about what he said that night. And I said, "Oh, my God, I'm so sorry." And he volunteered to send me a copy of the speech, but not just a written copy, but his delivery of it. And I must tell you, Melissa, when I received that speech, I was like gobsmacked. Like, bruh, not only did they have it right, you were so much more contemptuous of poor Black people than was previously announced. And I knew then I had to write something serious and sustained about Mr. Cosby. And at the end of that writing, right before the book was about to be published, the occasion of his further controversy around issues of sexual assault and rape and the like emerged. And I had about three or four pages, even at that late date, about the allegations of Ms. Constan against Mr. Cosby, Dr. Cosby. And I included them in the book. But to me, as horrid and as tragic and as utterly terrorizing are as the claims and allegations and conviction of Mr. Cosby around sexual assault are, equally offensive are his assaults upon poor Black people that often had the complicity of the poor themselves, not only because of his celebrity and fame, but as you know, the impulse toward self-help, toward self-inventory, toward a harsh self-rebuke that is often present in quarters of Black life, echoed in Mr. Cosby's comments. And therefore, it was very difficult to disentangle one from the other, or at least to show that in combination, those things wouldn't yield the greatest insight possible.
Okay, I want to pause here for a moment, because the next part of our conversation shifts to an allegation of sexual harassment made against Michael Eric Dyson in 2020 by a student at Georgetown University while he was a professor there. In 2021, the student-run magazine called the Georgetown Voice spoke with the student, who remains anonymous. And she told The Voice that while taking one of Professor Dyson's classes, he asked her to have dinner with him off campus, texted her directly, and initiated unwanted physical touching, including rubbing her shoulders during a class. Now, the allegation has not been widely reported on, but I thought it was important to address it during our conversation. All right, Michael, so we have known each other a lot of years. I think at this point, maybe even a lot of decades. So this is tough. It's a hard conversation, mm-hmm. but I can't be me and cover the things I cover and, you know, have some of the experiences that you know that I've had and not mm-hmm. ask you about this. So there were allegations of sexual harassment from your time as a faculty member at Georgetown University. And I understand that you have some legal restrictions about what you can speak about, but let me try to put it in the framework of the book. As you reflect across, I guess, three decades now of a public and scholarly career, what have you learned or changed about your own performance of Black manhood or Black masculinity that might be informed in part by your encounters and experiences with Black women, Black queer folk, who maybe have shed light on your own understandings of Black masculinity?
Mm-hmm. No, well, there's no question that, thank God, I stand to talk to you today as a human being who, as a Baptist minister, is conscious of his finitude, of his limits, of his flaws, of his foibles. Thank God I have no legal problem at all in regard to any particular standing in regard to any claim of sexual harassment or allegation or assault and so on. So thank God that is not the case, that I am indeed a guilty figure. However, the point you raise is extremely important, and that is that all of us have to be conscious of the ways in which, deliberately or inadvertently, we participate in a broader culture that victimizes vulnerable people. And I've spent an entire career defending Black women, standing up for Black women. As I said earlier, writing a book about Black women when it wasn't a thing, or defending gay and lesbian and transgendered and bisexual people and standing up for victims of all sorts of intimidation and terror. So it makes you, recognize that either consciously or unconsciously, all of us may be parts of cultures of you know, hurt and pain that have to be interrogated, that have to be asked questions of. And I'm a 63-year-old Black man in America. I'm a very effusive, loving, embracing Black man. I'm a Baptist preacher, you know, and until recently, given the sea change in relations in America around sexuality, I hugged everybody. I think, as you know, I man, boy,
I have hugged you more than once or twice. That is true.
Lord have mercy. So that's what I do. And, you know, those changes have been put in place because we are now living in a different era, a different time of challenge, a different point of recognition. And so for me, you know, I'm much more conscious of the necessity of being righteous and engaged with an awareness that, you know, certain claims of harassment exist in a universe of heightened awareness, whether intentional or not, or that certain perceptions of discomfort may arise. So we certainly have to be aware of that. But ultimately, what I'm aware of is the fact that at the same time, we live in a world where, you know, comfort cannot be the predicate for acts of justice or true recognition of what is and is not the case. And let's be honest, when we think about the intervention, the interaction of race and of class and of sexuality, you know, we can't forget the ways in which the criminalization of Black masculinity or Black sexual identities more broadly sometimes clashes with claims of a certain sort made in this country around sex that have to be taken seriously. So I've been heightened in my awareness of that and continue as a professor at Vanderbilt to be, you know, engaged in this project as both a scholar within a university setting and as a public intellectual to address these extraordinarily important and complicated matters.
Michael Eric Dyson, author of Entertaining Race, Performing Blackness in America. Thank you for joining The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all, that's all we have for you today. And as always, we appreciate you tuning in. If you missed anything or you want to listen back, check out our podcast. You can find us wherever you get your audio or head on over to thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. This is The Takeaway, and we're going to be back with you tomorrow.